21-6193, Connie Thacker versus Ethicon Incorporated et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Jez, you may proceed for the appellant.
May it please the court. Good morning, and my name is Sean Jez on behalf of appellant Connie Thacker. We are here before your honors this morning, and I would just note that I would reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We are here before the court because the district court did not follow the standard for summary judgment and essentially expected plaintiff to prove her case at the summary judgment phase. What the court should have done was viewed the evidence in the light most favorable to Thacker, the appellant, and drawn reasonable inferences from those facts in her favor. As the court knows, all reasonable inferences must be in favor of the non-moving party, Ms. Thacker, in this matter. And as a result of that, the court dismissed her claim for design defect and her claim for failure to warn, in addition to negligence and gross negligence. As this court knows from the many cases that have been cited in the briefs, this is not the first rodeo regarding transvaginal mesh cases. Ms. Thacker's case was one of tens of thousands of cases that had been pending before the multi-district litigation in front of Judge Goodwin in West Virginia. After the general discovery was completed in the MDL, Judge Goodwin began to remand cases to the federal courts from whence they had originated. Ms. Thacker's case was remanded and put into motion for case-specific discovery. Ms. Thacker had been implanted with two devices from the defendant, a ProLift to treat a prolapse, and then also a TDT Secure, which was to treat her stress urinary incontinence. Those devices were implanted by Dr. Geiler in May of 2009, and then because of the injuries that she suffered as a result of them, she had them removed during two separate surgeries. One surgery in 2012 by Dr. Parizo, which removed the ProLift, and then Dr. Veronicus, who removed the TDT Secure in March of 2019. In a design defect case, the Kentucky applies the risk utility test for design defects, and that is to determine whether an ordinarily prudent company, being aware of the risk, would not have put the product on the market. And just as a side note, as the court may or may not be aware, both of these products, the ProLift and the TDT Secure, have been removed from the market as a result of the litigation that was before the court in the MDL and the individual cases. The non-movement, Ms. Thacker must prove that there is a safer and reasonable alternative design with regard to that product under the design defect law in Kentucky. Ms. Thacker did do that by presenting her evidence in her summary judgment response by first showing that Dr. Rosen submitted specific and general reports to explain how the Ultra Pro is safer and more a feasible alternative. His opinions that the Ultra Pro was a safer, feasible alternative have been repeatedly found admissible and reliable by numerous courts. In fact, Judge Hood, who ruled in this matter, had earlier, not even 2 months earlier, ruled that the Ultra Pro was a safer and feasible design in the case of Sexton. Dr. Rosenzweig's...
He contrasted at some length both the argument and the specificity of the argument in Sexton and the specificity of the underlying opinion. He contrasted those with their counterparts here. I mean, he basically says that both the argument and the opinion itself were just totally conclusory. I mean, and at least the portions that he's pointing to of your brief, I mean, he says, you just say his opinions show it's feasible. And then he says he looked at the opinions, and the opinions just sort of announce that it's feasible.
Well, let me address it this way first, Your Honor. First, the appellee, the defendants in this matter, never argued against the feasibility of the product, the Ultra Pro product, in their summary judgment motion. Their only two arguments with regard to the Ultra Pro was that, one, it had not been approved by the FDA, and second, that the Ultra Pro would not have prevented the injuries that Ms. Thacker had. And so what the...
Okay, well, those are two significant arguments, aren't they?
Right, but the district court never addressed those two arguments. In fact, in footnote two of his opinion, he said, "I'm not going to address those."
Let's set aside sort of the omission, I guess, of defense counsel saying specifically, hey, UltraPro is not feasible in those terms, as opposed to UltraPro isn't approved. Why do you think Judge Hood was mistaken in saying this kind of conclusory argument backed by this kind of conclusory opinion in this case? And he's deciding this motion on the record in this case, not on the record in Sexton. It doesn't matter what happened over there. So why is he mistaken about that?
Well, he's mistaken, Your Honor, because the case-specific expert report that was presented as evidence in this case does specifically explain how the UltraPro device was a feasible and safer alternative. It has to, and in doing that, Dr. Rosenzweig refers to his general expert report, which was also attached as Exhibit G to the response to summary judgment, where Dr. Rosenzweig explains that the TDT Pro, TDT Secure and the ProLook that were implanted in this Thacker used smaller pores and heavier weight mesh, whereas the UltraPro used lighter weight mesh and had larger pores, which would not have caused the injuries that Ms. Thacker had, which were degradation of the product itself, scarring, shrinkage, scar plating, those type of things. He explains that in his report. In fact, we know that the district court...
About pages 81?
81 through 83 in his case specific, and then on pages 36 through 37 on his general report. Now, we know that the district court reviewed that information because he cites it, of the general report, because he cites it in footnote 3 of his opinion. Although he gives no deference to it, he says that, well, I read it, but then he doesn't apply the reasonable inferences that the plaintiff in the case was entitled to. And obviously, in reading that opinion, Dr. Rosenzweig's opinion, he goes through at length in multiple pages prior to where he talks about the UltraPro, about how the dangers of the TDT Secure and the ProLift, because it had the smaller pores and the heavier weight. There's at least three or four pages dedicated to that, and then he explains that the UltraPro is not like that.
Okay. Was there any Daubert motion with respect to any of this testimony?
There were some motions to exclude that were filed, but the court did not rule on those. He denied those as moot because his decision in the motion for summary judgment.
So they did file a 702 motion seeking to exclude. Did they try to exclude? I'm not suggesting there's an obvious deficiency. I just want to understand the posture. Were they seeking to exclude like both the specific and the general opinions, or just parts of one or the other?
They were looking to exclude his case-specific opinions, saying that they were unreliable and inadmissible. As the court is aware, based upon the numerous cases that are cited by the parties, at no point were Dr. Rosenzweig's opinions regarding the UltraPro ever determined to be unreliable or inadmissible. But again, the district court never reached that issue.
So conceivably, if we disagreed with the district court as to whether these opinions support feasibility, it's conceivable the district court then take up a Rule 702 motion and decide whether these opinions then satisfy that rule. Is that right?
But I would assume that is correct, Your Honor. I assume that Judge Hood would take up those motions. There were multiple motions on 702 filed for multiple experts, and then many, many motions and limitations that have been filed.
That's the way it goes in these cases.
Yes, Your Honor. There's a ton of paperwork in those cases.
A lot of 702 stuff.
Too much of it sometimes. Yeah. The other argument that we would address, Your Honor, is the failure to warn claim that Judge Hood granted in favor of the defendant in this case. And in the failure to warn claim, basically what the district court said is that the plaintiff failed to prove that the doctor would have changed his mind.
Isn't that what the doctor said? I mean, he seemed to say, even with everything I know right now, I'd do the same thing.
He did say that he thought it was still a safe and effective product for Ms. Thacker. However, he also didn't testify, and I believe that the district court did not give any deference to that opinion, is that at the time of that he implanted these devices into Ms. Thacker, he was unaware of certain complications such as chronic long-term pain, chronic inflammation, and chronic long-term sexual pain with the use of these products. He testified that he was unaware of those, and that had he known about that, he would have considered that when he did the risk-benefit analysis with Ms. Thacker. And I think what a lot of courts have failed to look at is that under the learned intermediary doctrine, it's not just a one-step process, what's the doctor going to do? It's actually a three-step process. One, you have to determine, one, were the warnings that the defendant gave the manufacturer adequate in this case? Second, was that inadequacy the proximate cause of the damages that the plaintiff suffered? And in doing that, you have to look at, one, what did the doctor know at the time? And he admits that he did not know about those conditions at the time that he implanted the devices into Ms. Thacker. And then third, what many courts don't look at, however, the Larkin and Quarter court did review, and that is, once the doctor makes his determination and he explains to the patient these are the possible injuries that you could suffer from this product, the patient then gets the ability to decide, do I want to have this device implanted in me or not? No courts have considered that except the Larkin and the Quarter court, whether or not the patient has the ultimate, well, the patient does have the ultimate and final say on whether or not I want this device implanted into my body. But no deference was taken into that decision. In Kentucky, there's a heeding presumption that had an adequate warning been given, the patient would have heeded that adequate warning. So at the time that Ms. Thacker was implanted with these devices, Dr. Geiler admittedly did not know about these injuries, and therefore Ms. Thacker could not have known about those injuries at the time that she was implanted with. Had she known about those, and had Dr. Geiler known, and had Dr. Geiler told her about those chronic injuries, Ms. Thacker could have made the decision at that point not to have the devices implanted in her.
And the jury then would have to decide that she would have decided against in order to recover?
That's correct.
So your theory then is, at least at this stage of your argument, that it's possible that the doctor could have looked at this and thought that it was still on balance a good thing to do, but would have warned in addition these other things, and the jury then could conclude, based on whatever evidence is in front of it, that the plaintiff would not have made that decision.
Absolutely, the jury would take a look at
that. That's consistent with the learned intermediary rule.
That's exactly consistent with the learned intermediary rule, because the plaintiff can then decide.
The district court didn't address that.
No, the district court did not address that. And then also what the court has to look at is that the jury can make reasonable inferences about the credibility of the doctor. There's evidence in this case that the doctor implanted over 300 of these devices. And so whether or not the jury thought that the doctor's testimony was credible as to, oh, I would have done it or not, the jury could take that into account.
She could actually testify. I wouldn't have done it if I'd known that.
Absolutely, she could testify to that.
The jury could not believe that as self-serving, but nonetheless, it would be some evidence that she wouldn't have taken that the doctor's advice at that point.
That is correct, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Amy Pepke, and I represent the appellees, defendants, Ethicon, and Johnson & Johnson. It is clear here today that what plaintiffs want this court to do is decide this case on a record that isn't before it.
I'm looking at an expert report, so I mean, when we get to it, my question is, why isn't this enough for feasibility? Just to speak to what you just said.
Well, let's go straight there.
Okay.
All right. So the district court found that there was not sufficient evidence of feasibility that the UltraPro could be a feasible alternative design. And that was a proper conclusion under this court's Sixth Circuit precedent on summary judgments, not in the Dauberts.
I get it.
So,
case are you talking about?
I'm talking about Automated Solutions Corporation, which is a 2014 case, 756 F3rd 504, and also Worldwide Equipment, 605 Federal 3rd 319, which is a 2010. case. So a decade of precedent that says on summary judgment, not in a letter.
I've litigated this stuff.
All right.
As a lawyer. I totally get it. I mean, sometimes, you know, the same reasons why it falls short of 702 means it's not worth anything for 56.
There's
I get that, but what is the problem with this opinion?
The problem with this opinion is that the case-specific report, which is the only report that plaintiffs cited to you in their motion for summary briefing and in their statement of material facts, that is the only report. It's an 83-page report. You know how many times it mentions UltraPro? Once.
Well, it's, okay, on page 81 and 82 is where the expert's getting into the UltraPro, I guess, possibility, right?
Yes.
And, I mean, he's talking about three other alternatives as well that the district court says that's just a different fork in the road therapeutically, and so those aren't really alternatives to this. But I thought he does go through with this, and he says that, you know, it's the stuff that your colleague pointed to, that, you know, it's got bigger pores and all this sort of thing, sort of, you know, beyond my ken, but why, well, it's just not obviously inadequate. So why is, he does talk about UltraPro. It is another product on the market. This is not some, you know, one of these cocktail napkin alternatives that you've probably seen in your litigation and I saw.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is another product. So what's the problem with this alternative?
There are several problems with it. He provides no data. He provides no science, no medical literature, no citations of case studies, no explanation of how a lighter weight, larger pore mesh, like UltraPro, which is a hernia mesh, could be cut down to 8 centimeters, which is the length in a TVT secure tape, and still support the urethra. Okay? This is a lighter weight mesh. It is larger pore. You cut that down, and you don't have the support. There's actually some testimony in his in Dr. Rosenzweig's deposition where he talked about how Ethicon had actually tried to use the UltraPro.
So you filed a 702 motion as to this report as well?
We did, Your Honor. And
the court didn't rule on that?
It didn't rule on it.
Was the thrust of it sort of a GEV joiner analytical gap between sort of the, you know, asserted bases and then the conclusion of the opinion? Or
there's a lot of 702 arguments.
Sure.
But yes, we in the defendant's Daubert briefing, they argued that there was it was unreliable. So there was a gap between the conclusion and the support for it. They specifically referred to the UltraPro opinion as conclusory ipsy dixit. That was not supported, but you don't have to get to the Daubert motions because this circuit has said that even on a summary judgment, expert reports must include the how and the why the expert reached the particular result. We don't have the how and the why, but there are hundreds of different meshes out there, hernia meshes, different meshes, and it's like he walked into none of you probably sew. I sew. I go to a material store and I walk in.
I love to sew.
Oh, well, good.
Yeah, I'm just joking.
You walk into a material store, if you've never been in, and there's just bolts of cloth, just all sorts of cloth. Some of it's silk, some of it's tough burlap-type cloth. Well, that's the same with meshes. Big pore, large pore, heavy, strong, not so strong, lightweight, flimsy. And he walks into a store and he says, this one over here, I like it a lot. It's UltraPro. It's lighter weight. It's larger pore. He doesn't do the next thing, which is, let me tell you why that would still work.
Yeah. Okay? I understand what you're saying.
So we're missing that completely. And that's in the court. District court was absolutely correct when they contrasted this case to Sexton. And that was a different report, and it was a different product, the TVT Exact. Dr. Rosenzweig had a different report he submitted. He also, I went back and checked, was designated as both general and case-specific. In that case, he was not designated as a general causation expert here. So in Sexton, to put it bluntly, the plaintiffs did their work. On the motion for summary judgment briefing, they went through the expert report. They went through the reliance. They cited case studies. Mm-hmm. They cited medical literature. They explained why, in their opinion, they were probably wrong, but they explained why, in their opinion, that his feasible alternative design was feasible.
Let me ask you this. As I understand, you did not argue before the trial court that Dr. Rosenweg's testimony was inadmissible. Apparently, the proceedings didn't get that far. So what would you say about that? The admissibility of this key expert's testimony, whether or not that was ruled upon?
Well, the admissibility issue is distilled down to where it's important is on the would prevent prong of the feasible alternative design. So I think we all agree that at summary judgment, parties often submit expert reports, retained expert reports in written form, and they're generally accepted as proper summary judgment evidence because they generally come with the assurance that those written opinions can be offered in admissible form at trial. But we have a problem here.
Well, the problem in terms of whether Judge Hood flipped the switch too quickly or too soon, all of that, your argument seems to be based in part on the contention that you disagree with Dr. Rosenweg's testimony, and if the admissibility of it wasn't ruled upon, you just have to wonder whether the plaintiff's action should have been thrown out of court, if that were, at least as to some of these allegations, if that was the key contention.
Well, I do think that some of the opinions should have been inadmissible and should not have been considered. But even if you let them all in, even if you look at all the reports as if they were properly before the court, they just don't get there. They're all conclusory.
So you did challenge admissibility, but the court didn't rule on that.
That is correct.
It didn't need to? Is that what happened?
I believe that that's what the court did. He kind of ruled in the alternative. He said, first, plaintiffs didn't do their job. That's what he said. They didn't cite me to the record. I got, you know, not a pig, truffle, all of that stuff. So that really, it could be affirmed on that ground alone. Plaintiffs didn't cite the general causation report in support of the UltraPro opinion. They cited it for something else. They cited it on the inadequacy of the warnings, but not on the UltraPro. And we and the defendants did object to the admission of the general causation in docket entry 247. I believe it's in the Daubert reply, page ID 11599, objected to its admission because he was not designated as a general causation expert here. I believe we also objected to it in the statement of material facts responses, but I'm not 100% on that. But it is in the record.
However, you briefed the summary judgment as though everything was admissible and seemingly even relied on Dr. Rosenberg. To some extent, in your arguments, I'm just wondering if the case of the trial court should have permitted the case to be further developed. It should have ruled on some of these evidentiary issues before throwing the case out, because as much here as it's really unsettled, it's certainly from an evidentiary standpoint. That's very key in determining whether summary judgment should have been granted. I'm just wondering why the district judge didn't just act too quickly here.
Your Honor, the judge did not act too quickly because there were no evidentiary disputes when it comes to the feasibility. They put in their evidence. I mean, they have to have an expert on that issue. And Dr. Rosenzweig is their expert on that issue. He is the case-specific expert. So we have the evidence that's there.
Well, it matters whether his testimony is admissible, as with the other expert witnesses. And then, normally, if they were admissible, the fact finder would have weighed those opinions as well as the credibility of the testifiers. And seemingly, you would have thought all that would have been presented and decided before dispositive motion was ruled upon. And that just didn't happen.
I respectfully disagree, Your Honor. I think what the district court did is follow this court's precedent. And in Worldwide Equipment, this court said, we know that expert witnesses cannot create a question of fact by simply stating conclusions on ultimate issues. A court is free to reject an argument having no factual basis. And that was on a summary judgment. And that is exactly what the
district... Wait a minute, though. Dr. Rosenzweig testified that no reasonable doctor would have done the surgery without adequate warnings. Presumably, that wasn't part of the district judge's consideration. And there's nothing in our precedent that says that kind of testimony couldn't be addressed or taken into account when the trial judge is confronted with a dispositive motion.
Well, as to Dr. Rosenzweig's testimony, it's a slightly different issue because he was addressing what he presumed to be the state of mind of surgeons if they didn't have risk information in the label. But the issue we have here is that our record, it's uncontroverted that Dr. Geiler, the implanting doctor in this case, knew. He wasn't uninformed. He actually knew, and he testified that he knew about every risk of injury that this plaintiff now claims. In fact, interestingly, in this case, we have something that we don't usually have. It's a consent form that she signed.
Well, you're going back to the issue whereby you're saying that your client would prevail if Dr. Geiler stated that he would have done nothing differently. Are we back at that? That seems like an oversimplification of the law here, because if that blanket statement was the determinant factor in every case, no case of this kind could ever succeed if the treating physician would testify and would be in his own interest to testify that he would have done nothing differently. That would be a completely unworkable legal framework.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree with that, and I see I'm running short on time, but I do want to fully answer that question.
You're not out of time yet.
To answer that question, we merely need to turn to this court's precedent in the Cutter case. And there the court found it's very similar. In fact, it involved the same implanting doctor. And
was I on that case?
You were.
I seem to be in all these cases.
We were thinking it wasn't merely coincidence and you just really liked the match cases.
Maybe I should look into that.
But in the Cutter case, this case aligns with it almost on all fours, except that our case is stronger. In Cutter, Dr. Geiler testified there that he, even knowing everything he now knows, that he still thinks that the prolif benefits outweigh the risk and that it was safe and effective. He didn't have that testimony in that case, that he stood by his decision even knowing everything he now knows. We have that. We have that testimony in this case that even knowing all of plaintiff's allegations regarding the inadequacy of the label, he stands by his decision. And the reason that is a dispositive fact is because it goes directly to proximate cause.
Marcy, you're out of time. Can I ask a question about that? Your opposing counsel makes an argument that response to that very point, which is what the district court relied on, that very language, right?
Yes.
Says, yeah, but that's not enough. Because if the jury believed that even though the doctor thought this was sufficiently safe and effective to go forward without committing malpractice, I know that's not the standard, but thought it was within the range of good medical process to do it, if the jury could find that he would have advised of the possibility, however small, that because of the notice, the warning, that then the patient would not have undertaken the operation, that would be sufficient. Is that bad law under Kentucky or not?
Well, plaintiff's interpretation of it is wrong. It's not the law in Kentucky. And I'm glad you raised it. It was the last point I had to make. That was the same issue that was in Cutter. In the Cutter case, except even there, it was different. It was stronger for them. In that case, plaintiff actually testified at her deposition that if she had received this information, whatever it was there, that she would have declined the surgery.
We said that was not relevant?
It was not relevant to the decision, and I'll tell you why it wasn't relevant. Under Larkin, which is the Kentucky Supreme Court's adoption of the learned intermediary doctrine, they held that underlying that doctrine, the learned intermediary doctrine, is the assumption a patient relies on the physician. And that assumption carries through the cases. I believe it's the Mitchell case we cited that reached the same decision. It underlines the Cutter decision. But even more importantly, in this case, we don't have plaintiff testimony on that point. In fact, we have the opposite. We have a signed consent form that disclosed these risks, the risk of pain with sex, chronic pain, erosion, failed product. So we have no reason to believe that there would be evidence that the plaintiff would have heeded anything, and there is not a heeding presumption.
She was deposed, correct?
She was deposed.
Was she asked this question?
She was asked if she was not, I don't know if she was asked it directly. I don't think she was, because I would have remembered if there was testimony.
I mean, maybe she wasn't asked, in which case she remains free to testify. I mean, I know they have to show there's a genuine issue, but normally that sort of stuff is cleaned up in a deposition.
Two points. The evidence from her deposition is that she relied on the doctor, she did no independent research, and she reviewed the consent form and signed it. But more importantly, again, I'll go back to the Cutter decision and the Mitchell decision and the Larkin decision.
Well, your red light's on, so you answered my question.
But it wouldn't matter what the patient did.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you, Your Honors. Let me start with the Cutter decision, because the Cutter decision, and Judge Kettledge, you are on that panel, although you did not write the opinion. The Cutter opinion, the reason that the failure to warn claim failed in that case was because Dr. Geiler testified that he did not review the IFUs in making his decision on whether he was going to implant that device in Ms. Cutter. In this case, Dr. Geiler testified that, yes, I did review the IFUs around the time that I implanted the devices in Ms. Thacker. So that's the huge difference in that case. And so here the doctor relied on everything that the manufacturer gave him, and then but he didn't know about all the risks, because I explained in my opening statements that there were other problems associated with the device that he did not know about.
Since, you know, we're short on time, to go back to this design defect feasibility issue, I mean, the argument, Ms. Pepke makes the argument, and I think Judge Hood basically said the same, which is that, you know, yes, your expert says that UltraPro was a feasible alternative. Yes, he says the mesh is bigger or smaller, whichever it was. That would be the mesh, bigger or smaller. That's like the data, so to speak. If we're going to put this in terms of, say, GE joiner, you know, that's the data. The conclusion is this would have been, this alternative would have worked better. But there's no explanation as to how you go from the differences he points to the idea that this product is going to do all the things it needs to do and not do the harmful things. And there is a separate line of authority, wholly apart from 702, in this court, that says a conclusory expert opinion doesn't create a genuine issue of material fact. And so I guess I'm wondering, I see, you know, what you're pointing to, but, and there's a lot of stuff there, but what there isn't, arguably, is an explanation of why this, these differences, or how these differences would yet perform the way he says.
And I'll briefly answer that question, Your Honor. If you look at his general expert opinions that were produced as Exhibit G to the summary response, prior to his discussions about the ultra pro, that being a larger pool, and the reasons why Ethicon did not adopt that that method or did not use that, he explains about the problems that the small pore, heavier weight mesh cause, and that if you,
what page are we talking about?
That's, I believe it starts on page 32 of his 32. Of his opinion.
Okay,
I believe it's 32 or 33, somewhere around there. He all goes right through and explains all about the problems with the smaller and heavier weight mesh, and as a result of that, had they used the Ultra Pro, which was the larger pore, lighter weight, she would not have had these type of problems that she
okay
did.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The case is submitted. I call the next case.